Sehr gut, sehr gut, sehr gut.
Sehr gut?
Wieso Steuer ist sehr gut? Das sagen ganz viele.
Cool, wer sagt das?
Stiftung Warentest, Computerbild, Focus Money, Chip, Finanztipp, such dir was aus.
Mega, aber das ist doch bestimmt kompliziert.
Nö, einfach Foto von der Lohnsteuerbescheinigung machen und fertig.
Klingt sehr gut.
Ist sehr gut. Hol dir dein Geld zurück mit Wieso Steuer.
Stu does America.
What a day. Follow the show on YouTube, youtube.com/StuDoesAmerica. Be sure to hit subscribe and click the bell for notifications. Jason Buttrell is back with the inside scoop of this weekend's ceasefire negotiations. We've got some brand new Jasmine Crockett wisdom to break down for you. I can't wait for that. But we're going to start by doing the art of the hostage deal. Yes. What a day. I don't even know how else to put it. Hamas has swapped the last Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners. Israeli military said it had received all hostages confirmed to be alive after their transfer from Gaza by the Red Cross, prompting cheering, hugging, and weeping among thousands waiting at Hostage Square in Tel Aviv. Let's give you a little picture of that. This is what it looked like in Tel Aviv. The Donald Trump signs being waved by the crowd there. They are cheering, the flags everywhere. This is a thrilling moment for the country, and one I don't know that they thought was coming. I mean, when, you know, an invading army comes in and kills 1,200 of your people and takes 250 hostages, there has to be a moment, right, as a country, as certainly even the family members, where you, in some ways, despite all of your hope and all of your prayers, there has to be at least a doubt that creeps into your mind that you're ever going to see them again. Maybe you're kind of written them off in your head. I'm sure that happened with some of these families, and yet here they are, hugging their relatives once again. I mean, just an incredible day as far as that goes. Now, direct meeting became true between Trump and Hamas leaders, which sealed the Gaza deal. One barrier to the deal was that Hamas leaders feared Israel would resume the war once the hostages were freed. In order to deliver a deal, one of the sources contended Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner had to meet with the Hamas leaders in person and directly assure them that Trump wouldn't let that happen as long as the group held up its side of the deal. And I think that is real, right? Like, Trump is not screwing around here. This is a big part of his legacy now. He's going to do everything he can to prevent Israel from just going back in there after this. He's trying to actually hold up a fair deal on both sides. This is what he does. And a lot of times, you know, it makes you feel weird, right? Like the fact that, like, you know, Hamas is going to get some sort of protection after this potentially can feel really weird. And I can understand why a lot of people don't like that. But this is what, you know, he believed was necessary to get this done. And it is actually done so far. There's a lot more to go through, and we'll go through that here in a second. But world leaders gathered in Egypt to throw their weight behind the Gaza ceasefire deal. U.S. and Egyptian presidents chairing a gathering of world leaders dubbed Summit of Peace on Monday to support ending the more than two-year Israel-Hamas war in Gaza after breakthrough ceasefire deal. Israel and Hamas have no direct contacts and were not expected to attend Monday's summit. But frankly, like, it's much more significant that these Arab countries are coming together in the, you know, other regional powers and saying, yeah, we're in on this. Like, we want to help. We want to be part of this. Israel has enough trust to say, OK, even though you guys have maybe threatened us in the past, we're going to look past that. We want the best for everybody here. Hamas, I think, is going to be much happier dealing with these nations and an international security force rather than a United States or Israel, certainly. So there's some hope there that maybe this turns into something real over a longer period of time. Now, there was a bunch of speeches that went down after all of this. It was quite entertaining, actually. Netanyahu started this off, and he was speaking about his relationship with the United States and Donald Trump, and more specifically, how unique Donald Trump was to make this happen. This isn't just generic praise of America, which is, you know, common from Israeli leaders. This is very specific. Trump is the guy who made this happen. Watch.
Just at that point of maximum pressure on Israel, a man named Donald J. Trump was elected president of the United States. And ladies and gentlemen, overnight, everything changed. Everything.
We felt it right here.
Mr. President, Thanks to your unequivocal backing of Israel, we secured a second hostage deal within weeks of your election. And in the months that followed, we worked closely together to forge a path to bring the remaining hostages home and end the war. End the war in a way that ensures the disarming of Hamas, the demilitarization of Gaza, and that Gaza would never again pose a threat to Israel.
To Israel is the way that clip got a little cut off there, but you get the point. What's fascinating about that, and look, there's a lot going on right now. A lot of people are very stressed out. A lot of people are saying all sorts of different things. What I would just mention here is listen to the way he's talking about Donald Trump and what Donald Trump did for Israel. You know, there's a lot of theories out there. A lot of people believe in a lot of different things. You should follow that to the end conclusion a little bit. And if you do, I don't know, it might put you in a position where you question some of those thoughts. Because, frankly, if you believe all this stuff about Israel, a lot of people saying a lot of bad things about Israel these days, you believe those, you got to believe Donald Trump's in on it. Whatever you think Israel is going down, you got to believe that Israel is going down that road with him. And with his approval, I mean, all the information we're hearing about a lot of this stuff is coming from the Trump administration. Trump is out there helping Israel end this war, putting some pressure on them, I think, to get there. But basically nonstop praise of Israel throughout. I mean, let me give you an example of this. This is Bibi Netanyahu talking about Donald Trump and the relationship they have with Donald Trump sitting right next to him. Watch.
My friends, this is only a partial list. But it's enough to affirm what I've said time and again. Donald Trump is the greatest friend that the state of Israel has ever had in the White House.
I mean, they've had some good buddies. You know, it's not like there's been tons and tons of hardcore opponents to Israel in their life as a nation, at least most recent form. That's a fascinating thing for him to say, and it is something important to consider here. I mean, you know, look, you can criticize Trump if you want. If you think he's done all these terrible things, you could say that. But you should say it, I think. I mean, if you really believe this is what Israel is doing, you gotta kind of believe Trump is there, too. And I don't know. It seems like a strange thing to have voted for, certainly. So anyway, you can go down that road if you choose. Trump was in his element there. I mean, he's got guys just heaping praise on him all over the place. He's there. He's jocular. He's busting on people. He's telling stories. He's talking about how much Joe Biden sucked. It was great. I got to say, sometimes you forget with Donald Trump, there's a reason why the guy was a celebrity, right? Like, he's an entertaining guy. And just because he's president of the United States, some people love him, some people hate him. And that's what's kind of overwhelming. When he gets in these moments where he's just like laying it out there and just doing something fun that's not necessarily, in this instance, divisive. I mean, the audience was very receptive to everything he was saying. It is fascinating to see him in that mode because this is Trump at his happiest doing this job. Let me give you first a taste of who he blamed for getting everybody into this problem in the first place.
Once you go back a couple of years, if I were in charge and the country was doing what they were, nobody was going to ask me to speak. Nobody asked Joe Biden to come up and speak, I guarantee you that. And if they did, he would have turned them down, I promise you. He didn't speak. He didn't speak, and he didn't speak well. But all of the countries in the Middle East, it could have, what we're doing now, it could have happened a long time ago, but it was strangled and set back almost irretrievably by the administrations of Barack Obama and then Joe Biden. It was, there was a hatred toward Israel. There was an absolute hatred. The setbacks really started when President Obama signed the Iran nuclear deal. This was a disaster for Israel, and it was a disaster for everyone. And I remember that Bibi Netanyahu came to the United States and worked so hard to try and get Obama not to do that deal.
Yeah, and that's true. And they did it anyway, and it was a disaster, as you one would expect. It's now no longer in standing, thankfully. But there's a close relationship that went on this entire time. And, you know, like I said, there's not a lot of presidents that have been opposed to Israel, at least not in their public words. We definitely have seen a more negative turn toward Israel by a lot of Democratic presidents. And probably the biggest difference would have been if Kamala Harris got in. Remember, Kamala Harris was behind the scenes pushing Joe Biden to be more anti-Israel. As we've said many times on this program, when Biden was in office and we were talking about this, Biden didn't seem all that pro-Israel to me. I mean, like, his words at times were pro-Israel, but his actions, I thought, were not. And Kamala Harris, one of the main criticisms, when she was asked, hey, can you separate yourself from Biden in any way? What did he write? What did he wrong? She, of course, famously in The View said, I can't think of anything. She's later updated that thought to be like, I should have been tougher on Israel. So, like, this could have gone a much different direction, and it is incredibly significant. I wanted to show you this, though. This is Donald Trump just kind of busting on Marco Rubio, who's been doing, you know, by all reporting, a good job. You know, something, one of the rare things is sort of unifying many factions on the right. Some who are critical of Donald Trump really love his pick of Rubio and the things that he's done. Here is Trump talking about Rubio.
And I have a prediction that Marco will go down, I mean this, as the greatest Secretary of State in the history of the United States. I believe that. I believe it. And he and I, you know, we really fought it out. You remember, he was tough. He was nasty. Who the hell thought this was going to happen, Marco, right? And now I'm saying he's going to go down as the greatest. He will. He was always smart and sharp, and people respect him.
He really is incredible when you think back to the 2016 primary of how far they were apart. And you think back at Rubio, who kind of seemed like he was a big rising star through the Tea Party. I think he was, you know, I would consider him one of the favorites going into that primary. Not necessarily, the top guy, but was up there. And never really caught on, and then had that weird like 3-day turn where he turned into like Triumph the Insult comic. You know, it was like all of a sudden he was just like insulting him, and then he turned around again and was like, I shouldn't have done that. It's not me. And he had like a pretty good speech on the way out. And that was like, people were like, is this it for Marco Rubio? The answer to that was no. He's really turned it around. He became a very respected senator throughout that period. And then Secretary of State, and seemingly doing about half the jobs in the White House right now. So that's been kind of interesting. What does this mean for the Middle East? Donald Trump has a prediction, or at least a hope for what the path is forward. Here he is talking about it.
This is not only the end of a war. This is the end of an age of terror and death, and the beginning of the age of faith and hope and of God. It's the start of a grand concord and lasting harmony for Israel and all the nations of what will soon be a truly magnificent region. I believe that so strongly. This is the historic dawn of a new Middle East.
So there you go. Big hopes, certainly, for the region. Now, you might expect the reaction when anything happens with Donald Trump. It's always a bad reaction, right? The media goes negative. They go terrible. There was a lot of that, but also some positive. Let me give you Sam Harris. Harris talking with Jason Cohen about this deal in the Middle East, and he had some nice words.
Trump got a deal done, and that's something I don't believe you believe would have happened under a President Harris.
It pains me somewhat to admit this, but yes, he's certainly been good for the Middle East and for Israel in a way that I don't think there was any reason to expect Harris to be good. And Biden certainly wasn't good, apart from the first few weeks after October 7th, or maybe a couple of months after October 7th.
He's not a fan of Donald Trump, but giving him appropriate credit, I think that's good. And of course, this has been going on for a while. It's not, it shouldn't just be a couple of examples I can pull out. I mean, the captives themselves were saying this was the main difference. I want you to listen to one of them speaking out about this. This is from a couple of months ago, but you may have missed it. What was the change when Donald Trump came in? And what do they expect between Trump and Harris? What was the difference? Watch.
Yes, it's him. He got me out. He got the hostages out. Before, we felt like nothing is happening, And I remember there, ever since he came into the role, they were very scared of him. Yeah, they wanted...
Who?
Terrorists.
We're afraid of Trump.
Yeah, they wanted Kamala to be chosen, to be elected.
You talked politics with them?
Yeah. They wanted Kamala to be elected. But as soon as Donald Trump was elected, they understood that he wants to bring the hostages back home. Yeah. So immediately the way they treated me changed. So it's if it's the amount of food, I could say this, that when Trump became president, yeah, the way they treated us changed for me personally. This is what I think felt.
Because they anticipated that a deal would come soon.
Yeah.
And that's when they started giving you more food.
Exactly. More food, treated me better, you know, stopped cursing me, stopped spitting on me.
They were spitting and cursing?
Yeah.
Were they beating you?
No, never. I was never, except the 7th of October, I was never abused physically. But I think it's because the way I managed around.
The relationship.
Yeah.
Mm, I mean, that's, gosh, jarring. How do you feel if you're Kamala Harris hearing that? You know, certainly we can all say she probably has no soul and feels nothing. But I mean, I'd have to feel pretty terrible about the fact that, like, the terrorists were hoping for her to be elected. Imagine if that was you. The terrorists were wanting me to be elected. Like, I mean, again, she was very close to the Hamas side of the party. So I don't know if that is too effective to her. I will also point out that even CNN admitted this truth. This is from an early morning article that we screenshotted for a reason. It's 2 years after October 7th, Trump arrives in Israel having accomplished what Biden could not. That's how CNN put it. Of course, if you go back there now, we couldn't find that anywhere. We instead found this in its place. When Biden visited Israel, wounds were fresh and tension was mounting. 2 years later, Trump arrives with prospect of peace. So, like, that much more generic story, not really saying Biden couldn't pull this off, but that's where it goes. And I will say, like, it is important to note, and I mean this sincerely, there's a lot of stuff to come still. This is not going to be, let's call it, easy after what we've seen here. We had this, and we presented this to you a couple weeks ago, or whenever this started. I think, did I have the date on here? End of September, 20-point proposal for peace in the Gaza Strip, ending Israel-Hamas war. This was the proposal from Donald Trump. How many of those are done? Is a good place to start today. Well, they're not exactly chronological. It doesn't start at, one is the first thing. I'll give a couple of these to you. Gaza will be de-radicalized, terror-free zone that does not pose a threat to its neighbors. I certainly don't think we can say that one's accomplished yet. That's more of a longer goal. Same with number two. Gaza will be redeveloped for the people, benefit of the people of Gaza who have suffered more than enough. There's talk and hope that that eventually happens, but obviously it hasn't happened quite yet. There are things that have happened in here, and let me go through the things that seemingly have checked off of this list. If both sides agree to this proposal, the war will immediately end. Israeli forces will withdraw to the agreed-upon line to prepare for a hostage release. During this time, all military operations, including aerial and artillery bombardment, will be suspended, and battle lines will remain frozen until conditions are met for the complete stage withdrawal. I think we can check off at least a good chunk of that one. Number four, within 72 hours of Israel publicly accepting this agreement, all hostages alive and deceased will be returned. We can basically say that's done. Now, the deceased, that's not there yet, but we think it's in process. Some people are saying, hey, we haven't seen all the remains yet. Look, I want the remains to be returned. It's important, particularly to Jewish culture and Israel in general, to get the remains back. However, obviously, it's, to my mind, still secondary, of course, to the living hostages that have 100% been returned. Once all hostages are released, Israel will release a 250 life sentence prisoners plus 1,700 Gazans who were detained after October 7th, 2023, including all women and children detained in that context. For every Israeli hostage whose remains are released, Israel will release the remains of 15 deceased Gazans. So, like, you get the idea here. This is typical of these arrangements, by the way. Israel gives up, gets 20 people and gives up, 2,000. It's like 100-to-1 ratio typically in these types of arrangements. But that is pretty significant. And those three, I would say, of the 20, you could say at least are close to being checked off. I mean, Palestinians are complaining about not getting everything they wanted. Israel is going to complain about that as well. But that's three. There's a 20-piece process. I mean, let's see how much of this is. All of these are the other. All of these. And the first two are not done. It's a tough road ahead. right? It's going to be difficult. And whether this gets across the finish line as something bigger than just the hostages getting released, which is, of course, a big deal. If it's more than that, there's a lot of work to do. And that's okay. But it is important for all of us to realize that that's true. It is also okay, however, to step back and actually just applaud an accomplishment. This is an amazing day. This is something that most people did not think could happen. Certainly, I went most of my life looking at Israel and Hamas and, you know, the Palestinians and thinking it's never going to be solved unless, you know, God comes down from the heavens. This isn't going to happen. You know, miracles do happen, though, and you always have to allow for the possibility of a miracle. The hostages are back. That's a miracle. This is something that actually happened. You know, this isn't one of those things where, you know, every once in a while you have like a trade in the NBA where one player goes to the other team and then they're like, oh, he failed the physical. We're going to reverse it and send him back. That doesn't happen in this, right? Like if something gets screwed up later on, the Palestinians aren't like, all right, I guess I got to go. Or excuse me. The Israeli hostages aren't like, I guess I got to go back to Gaza now. This thing didn't work out. This is done. It happened. They're home. They're hugging relatives. They're celebrating on social media. This is real. It's a real thing. And Donald Trump deserves a ton of credit. He also gave credit to people like Marco Rubio, Jared Kushner, Whitaker, all the people who were involved in this. But, you know, Trump is the guy at the head of that. And if his guy screwed up, he deserves some blame for it. He deserves massive, massive credit here. The Palestinians, you know, will get back, as I mentioned, about 100-to-1 ratio. Some of these people will be really bad people. Some of these people will be people that will try to reconstitute terrorist attacks and groups to go back against Israel. That we know. You know, Sinwar himself was one of these guys that was released from a previous situation years ago and then wound up becoming head of Hamas. Like, these things are happening. You gotta watch them. There's no reason to believe this is going to be squeaky clean. We're going to look back at this and say, wow, that went wrong and that went wrong and that went wrong. But at least there's a chance of things going right, too, which is not where we were very recently. Trump has handled Israel very well. I have no real notes here. And the same thing goes for Israel. Israel could have many times, you know, done what every Democrat does and look for a reason to speak out and bash Donald Trump. They didn't do that. They said, let's make the real thing, the first thing, right? Like, what's the priority here? It's the protecting the people of Israel. We need Donald Trump. We need America on our side. And they were very careful with that relationship. And both sides, I think, managed it very, very well. This isn't just Trump bloviating. This is a real thing that happened. It is a massive accomplishment, no matter what the media tells you. This is a big deal. It's something that all presidents have tried to get done forever. And because of Trump's different approaches, he was able to get it across the finish line. This is going to cement a big part of Trump's legacy going forward. But, you know, it's part of his legacy has always been the art of the deal, right? And the media told you from the beginning that the art of the deal was sort of a joke, right? Well, you know, it's not a joke to Israel. It's not a joke to those families. And I don't think anybody can argue that it's a joke today. This is a big deal. And Donald Trump deserves a lot of credit for it. There are those who lead and there are those who follow. And when it's time for you to buy or sell a house, especially in a market like this, you want the person, the leader kind. You don't want the follower kind. A bunch of years ago, I don't even remember, 15 years ago now, Glenn got really fed up with the sort of follower types, right? He wants the leaders. And he decided to do something about it. And he created realestateagentsitrust.com because he didn't want to go through all this nonsense that he had to go through over and over and over and over again. And he didn't want you to have to deal with that either. Real Estate Agents I Trust pairs you with the best real estate agent in your area. Someone who knows the best practices, someone who understands the crazy housing market, someone who is a team leader and a closer, somebody you can trust from the beginning. If you're thinking about buying or selling a home or both, please get in touch with them. You'll see what I mean. It's realestateagentsitrust.com. The name says it all. Go to realestateagentsitrust.com, realestateagentsitrust.com.
Unsere Empfehlung für deinen Podcast? Frisches Obst und knackiges Gemüse von Aldi. Immer gut, immer günstig, immer vielfältig. Kurz gesagt, frische für alle. Zum Aldi-Preis. Diese Woche Zespri Sangold Kiwi. Das Stück für nur 55 Cent. Oder dunkle Tafeltrauben. 500 Gramm für nur 1,79 Euro. Entdecke jetzt viele weitere Angebote in deiner Aldi-Nord-Filiale. Und weiter geht's. Einfach lauschen und genießen. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
Joined now by Jason Buttrell, head writer and researcher for Glenn Beck. Of course, the Glenn Beck program airs here on Blaze TV. Jason, thanks so much for coming on the program.
You betcha.
Big day. We just went through all of the latest developments. You know, went through a bunch of Trump's speech and everything else. But like, think about the last 100 years. You know, I don't know where this thing turns out at the end, but like, this is a pretty massive day.
I mean, is it though? Didn't you see the Obama administration or the Biden administration trying to take credit for it? Be like, oh, it's a good thing they just kept on with what we were already doing. You know, we could have had peace in the Middle East a long time ago. We said screw it and decided to just let it play out on its own.
This is just like him trying to cure cancer. Like, and obviously, unfortunately, you're finding out he was not able to do that.
So ridiculous how they are trying to frame this now. Take any kind of credit whatsoever is just bizarre. It's unreal. But I mean, the way that the Trump administration was able to do this was completely just way out. They not only looked for, you know, more fish in the barrel, they completely grabbed a new barrel and rewrote the way that they these things have been handled over the past forever, since the 40s, basically. They cut out, it seemingly like before you would just go through like Qatar and have a bunch of shady dealings through the Qatari government, have them, you know, reach out to Hamas, do all these things. The Trump administration said, screw that. They went to pretty much look like, you know, the foundation of the Abraham Accords and you know, invited all those different nations to kind of play a part in this. And having it, you know, signed and the appearance in Egypt was, I think, a really big step in this, showing that this is more about a coalition of willing Arab partners. And I think that it speaks volumes towards, you know, the model that they're going towards in the future, specifically building upon the Abraham Accords. Now we look at it once they're kind of united in this common goal and it appears to be successful. We're looking at who's going to join it next. Is it the Saudis? That would be the big one. That would be a huge one. If they can jump on board, we can get lots and lots more jumping on board. Who knows where this could go? And it's very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like there's a real chance here. And part of it is Trump is good at setting up these discussions and arrangements in ways that have sort of a predetermined outcome. You know, like he comes out and he announces, hey, me and Bibi just agreed here. Me and us and Israel, we're in agreement. The deal's done. All we got to do is wait for Hamas. It's like, well, then all the pressures on Hamas to actually come along. They had rejected proposal after proposal after proposal after proposal. And now they're like, I guess, yeah, well, like, okay. So they accept this thing. The same thing, I think, is being set up with these Arab partners in that, like, if they come in and they're part of this overarching sort of government in Gaza, if a Hamas or a Hamas offshoot winds up doing things that are bad and someone cracks down, it's not the Israelis. It's likely these Arab partners who are there trying to maintain peace. And it sets up a totally different dynamic. It's hard to blame the Jews if, you know, an Egyptian troops are in the middle of cracking down on terrorists. It's a good change and could be a change that could benefit not only Israel, but everybody in the region.
Oh, for sure. And right now, what we're looking at is exactly what you laid out. What happens next? The big one is the demilitarizing of Hamas specifically. And not only that, but can these, you know, Arab partners, some of these other people that are going to be taking over security or overseeing it at least, can they do what is stated that they can do, which is oversee that demilitarization and make sure that, you know, more offshoots don't spring up. And you have, see, I remember one of the craziest realizations that I've had, and I've looked at, you know, these scenarios in the past in the Middle East. But one of the craziest ones I had was when I was actually in Iraq a few years ago. And I remember looking at some space with some Kurdish Peshmerga, and we were looking at like a de facto borderline that they had, you know, built this big dirt berm. And it was kind of like, I guess, kind of sealing off or showing Kurdistan, the northern Iraq, Kurdistan area from the rest of Iraq.
Yeah.
And I was like, why did you even put that there? And they said power vacuum. And I was like, what do you mean power vacuum? And he goes, well, now that ISIS is not there, we're now looking at all the different militias that are going to be rolling into this space and that are now going to be, you know, claiming it. They're the ones that we have to look out next. And they were like, this is the story of the Middle East. No matter where you're at in the Middle East, power vacuum will decide what happens here in the future, and it's going to happen. So right now, what we're going to have in Gaza is a power vacuum. And we spoke about this before, about all the different, you know, multiple different armed groups in Gaza that will now be vying to, you know, take up that mantle and fill that power vacuum. Will it be Hamas still somehow trying to cling to power in an appeared demilitarized way? Will they go away? Will it be another group like Palestinian Islamic Jihad? Will it be another group of, you know, offshoot of multiple different people from the other groups coming together, forming something new, making it appear that it's, you know, something a little bit more, I don't know, or something less scary.
Right.
But we know what they want to do. That's what I'm looking at now. How will they manage this power vacuum? How can they keep Gaza from being a staging point for another attack on Israel later? Very, very critical time right now if that can be managed. And as you said, you know, the way the Trump administration and the Israelis have kind of built this, it's now on, you know, these Arab partners. Can they, you know, manage this? If they want, you know, a larger peace in the region, or, you know, at least a more cooperative, you know, region.
Right.
It's now on them to make sure that happens. And they have a lot of incentive to do it, too. I mean, they are completely locking Iran out of this totally, which is something that hasn't happened in decades in this region. Iran is being completely locked out of these decisions.
That's great.
Awesome.
Yeah. I keep going back and thinking about this and how it's all developed. And it is kind of a stunning turn of events, right? Like, I don't know how long ago we would have thought this was really probably never going to happen. And you have now this 20-piece plan. To be clear, this is one piece of it, right? And it's an early piece. But what's fascinating about this is Hamas really, like, something like them disarming or something like them not being able to govern, which is a, you know, future part of the plan. They have no leverage to fight back against that stuff now because they've given up the hostages. This is great for the hostages, great for the families. But, like, I don't know where this winds up going. And I do think that in this 20-step process, there's a lot of pitfalls, and it may very well fail at some point during this process and something else might go wrong. But, like, what I keep coming back to is this: the hostages are actually home. This actually happened. Like, this is over. Like, they're not going to be brought back because another part of this negotiation fails or some other part of the deal fails. They're not going to have to go back to Gaza. This is it. It's this accomplishment is there, and it's miraculous.
Yeah, it really is. And what a comparison. I think back to over the many decades when random U.S. president would, you know, in a Hail Mary, invite like Yasser Arafat to Camp David or something equivalent to that. And it would be hailed all over the world. Like, hey, they're talking. You know, he flew to Camp David. Something might happen. 9 times out of 10, it wouldn't happen. Every once in a while, something would come out of it. Usually Israel would get screwed in the deal, but Israel would give it up for, you know, greater peace and stability. Now we actually have the start of a legit peace plan. Hostages have been turned over. The violence has stopped, and they are on a path to something very, very exciting. And it's kind of hilarious that, you know, they're not giving it even more of the kudos than it deserves. So even I actually saw Hillary Clinton, it must have been through her teeth, saying, you know, I give it to the Trump administration for getting us this far.
You should be able to do that. It should be easy in a moment
should
like
be,
this.
But how much did that hurt?
Yeah,
you know it did. This is over like something very, very exciting. This is about peace in this area that we haven't had in a long time. Mm-hmm. If this goes anywhere near, Stu, and I said this with you before, anywhere near Palestinian statehood, I am going to lose my
mind. Can't be rewarded.
Mind. There cannot be a reward.
Can't be a reward Better for what not. They did on October 7th.
And, oh my gosh, no.
And look, the people showed these pictures like, look at this devastation. I think it was Leon Wolf who said, you know, starting a war and then losing it badly is not a genocide.
Right.
Like, that's you started this war. You lost it. It was really ugly. Yes, it's true. There's a lot of rubble, the debris, as Trump said, all over this. That is all true. It's also the appropriate response to what happened on October 7th, in my mind. I don't want to leave, though, before switching subjects a little bit on Antifa. Mm. They have been in the news quite a bit, potentially a terrorist group. Trump has, you know, signed something to that effect. But you had a little bit of a visit with Glenn this weekend and a couple of FBI agents. What the heck happened?
So we did a show last week. You know, we're making fun. There was a social media clip, I think, this weekend where they were showing how on cue, almost as if they received a written notice, all the media personalities were saying this was a decentralized, yeah, leaderless movement. Yes. All of them saying it. And we were tracking that last week. So we're like, well, let's just make a quick little case, you know, based off of just information that we know, other open source information, where we can easily debunk that and show that there is a network involved. Well, yeah, the FBI was interested in that, reached out to Glenn over the weekend. I was actually at the mall with my wife on a Saturday, mm-hmm, and on last Saturday. And then Glenn was like, called me up and said, hey, do you think you can be here by 6? I was like, why? And he was like, because the FBI is coming to talk about the show on Wednesday. I'll be there at 6. Stu, it was a cool meeting. It was definitely, it shows that the FBI and the DOJ are being serious about looking into a lot of these networks and really turning on over every stone. Not just looking at this as Antifa as like a leaderless or a decentralized group, right, but the possibilities that it might be a larger network, especially with funding. I've never seen, one of the most surreal moments of my life, Stu, we have 3 FBI agents. They're sitting across from us. I'm sitting next to Glenn, and they asked about the Tides Foundation. Mm. Glenn goes off for like 15 minutes, giving like a monologue from back at Fox, and starts going through all the little ins and outs, describing what they're all about. I'm just staring at this, and I'm like, I cannot believe this. If the FBI would have been this concerned, or an administration been this concerned, and actually being, you know, real about getting to the bottom of, you know, radical left-wing violence, if they would have just done the same thing with Glenn back in, what, 2010? Whenever he was talking about that, yeah, think about all the damage we could have stopped from then until now. It would have been a different country today.
Mm. So overall, do you think it was a good thing? Like, is this a positive that they're looking into it? I mean, because part of me says, like, gosh, like, I feel like when we're putting a show together, like, we're hoping to get FBI sources to tell us about how deep the networks are. The fact that they're asking questions of you guys, like, it's cool because it means you guys did a relevant show that has good information to it. But also, like, isn't it concerning that the FBI is coming to us? Like, it doesn't make any sense.
I think what's concerning is the fact that before, you know, federal law enforcement or the government didn't even consider things like this. Mm. It's clear that, you know, during the Obama days, the Biden days, they clearly didn't give a crap. They could have given a crap, you know, and it's not surprising because a lot of those dark money networks funded them as well. You know what I mean? So, I mean, it's concerning that they never had looked at that before. Mm-hmm. But what gives me hope is now there's clearly a new sheriff in town. They're clearly willing and interested in going, you know, after every single person that might be involved in these groups. And I don't know if they'll find anything. It's possible that, you know, it leads to a lot of dead ends, but at least now they're looking for, you know, light in those dead ends and they're going after it. So I'm very hopeful for what the future might bring.
That's good. That's good news. It's good. We give it occasionally. There's occasionally good news on this program. Jason Buttrell, head writer and researcher for Glenn Beck, and apparently FBI witness. I don't know. appreciate it coming on, Jason.
Consultant.
Yeah, consultant. There you go.
You bet.
Kaffee in seiner besten Form mit der neuen Cubo One Kapselmaschine von Tchibo. In jeder Cubo-Kapsel steckt Spitzenkaffee aus besonderen Anbaugebieten. Für Espresso, Kaffeecrema oder Kaffee Grande auf Knopfdruck. Die neue Cubo One überzeugt mit Premium-Design, kompakter Größe und kleinem Einstiegspreis ab 29 Euro. Dank innovativer Press-Brew-Technologie wird jede Tasse besonders aromatisch mit samtiger Crema. Entdecke jetzt die Cubo-Kapselmaschinen in deiner Tchibo-Filiale und auf tchibo.de.
Noted Russian asset Donald Trump is in the news again. He is warning Russia that he may send Ukraine long-range tomahawks if Moscow doesn't settle the war soon. It's an interesting approach from a guy who's dedicated to Vladimir Putin as his main goal in life. But first of all, he hasn't done it yet, so maybe he won't. It does seem, though, that there is a change in tone. And this is one of the things that, you know, kind of follows up on our conversation on Israel today. One of the reasons why Donald Trump is able to get this stuff done is he comes at it from a totally different way And that doesn't always work. It's not always the best thing to do, frankly. Like, sometimes it doesn't work, and sometimes it gives you bad results. I'll give you an example, if you don't believe me, that I would criticize him on something like this. But, like, I think the way he treated Canada over the past year has been rough, and I think it led to a bad outcome. I think he gave an election to a radical left-wing nut job that could have gone to someone sane because of the way he stirred things up in Canada. So it's not always great. Israel is a really good version of it. And, you know, I think the Russia-Ukraine thing is tough because a lot of people will tell you, well, it's not going to work with Russia. They're not going to go along with this. And it might be true. But as I've said for a while here, I think the fact that we can create an opportunity for something good to happen is sometimes worth just giving it a shot. I mean, what have we lost, you know, when it comes to his approach with Russia? He could have been harder on Russia. He could have been nicer to Russia and harder on Ukraine. He could have changed his formula. I think he's tried both ways. It seems like right now he's saying, look, it seems like the problem here is not Zelensky right now. It seems like the problem is Putin. And he's now much more critical of Putin and starting to push more in that direction. We'll see how that goes after sort of the afterglow of Israel fades a little bit. We also have new information from Jasmine Crockett. Now, she's in the polls. Let me give you a couple quick polls here for the Texas Senate primaries for 2026. Leading the race is Paxton with 34%, Cornyn in second, 33%. That's too close for comfort, frankly, in that race. Wesley Hunt is third at 22%. I think all three of them would win against the Democratic opponent, which is why I'm very excited about the Democratic side of this poll, which has Jasmine Crockett leading. Now, she's not officially in the race yet, but she's got 31% of the vote. Beto O'Rourke and Tallarico are at 25%. And the guy that we were told was the secret genius is at 13%, Colin Allred. Doesn't seem like anyone wants him involved. But, I mean, why wouldn't you vote for Jasmine Crockett? Like, after you see an incredible piece of wisdom like this.
I cast my no vote. Because ain't nobody come at me and ask me what the people in my district need. Right. They didn't ask me what would look good for those in South Dallas. Right. They didn't ask me about that. So listen, I got people that I serve that are counting on me to do their work and to be their voice and not work for him. I don't work for him. He can't hire me. He can't fire me. The people that elected me in Texas 30 did. So unless you want to have a conversation with me about the priorities for the people in my district, baby, you're not getting this vote.
That's
so
right.
Listen. He can do whatever he wants to do, but this will be on the Republicans. I need people to tune in and learn how to count and learn who controls what. If you want things to function, maybe put the Democrats back in control. Now, I know people got beef with the Democrats not being as aggressive as we should have been, especially since we got him over here just running ramshot over everything. But at a very minimum, you can always count on there being level-headedness and responsibility when it comes to Democrats, because they care about federal workers. Mm. They care about our constituents and making sure that those services are still available, because when the government shuts down, then that impacts our constituents directly. It does.
I don't know if after that rant you want to be talking about level-headedness. I don't know if that's the exact appropriate time for that. But I will say, I totally agree with the sentence, I cast my no vote because ain't nobody coming me. I mean, I don't think you can deny that. Finally, last piece, we have Katy Perry and Justin Trudeau are together. Of course, 100% organic news release. This was definitely not these pictures that are taken from a distance. Definitely not. They didn't know this was coming at all. Definitely not, completely leaked to the media intentionally. She goes from what was the elf in the Lord of the Rings to the Canadian prime minister. Is that a step up or step down? I would say it's step down. I mean, I don't know. Can we look at that headline again? Because I'm not sure if I can tell from that distance with the telephoto lens whether he was wearing blackface or not on the date. But really happy for them. And certainly will be another fruitful relationship for Katy Perry. Back in a second. Okay, so here's what happened. You know, a lot of people know the truth, which is, of course, everything natural is always better than anything man-made. This is why I'm sitting to you in an air-conditioned studio. forget I mentioned that, but I should point out that if you're ever sick, obviously the answer is always a natural solution. You know, ancient Chinese secret, right? You go to that most of the time. At least a Chinese woman has swallowed 8 live frogs to ease her back pain. You're going to be shocked to hear she should have gone Advil instead, I would say. Didn't work out very well. Some digestive problems. Look, you're an idiot if you swallow 8 live frogs. I wouldn't go over 5. At least, well, I mean, at least not in one day. I mean, come on, in a week, sure.